Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of October. Oh, we are going to have so much fun this hour of the program, because we are going to begin the hour with a fairly profound question. Why are we mortal? Why couldn't we be bodies maintaining themselves for 1,000 years? There are gerontologists who believe that we can. I don't know if we want to or not, but a lot of people want to live for a long, long time. In this hour of the program, our guest is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. Jonathan Weiner is our guest. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Break of the Finch. And today, scientists and researchers and entrepreneurs believe that human immortality is not only possible, but it is attainable in our own time. Our guest is one of the most distinguished popular science writers in the country. His books have won the Pulitzer, as I said, the National Book Critics Circle Award and the LA Times Book Prize. He's written for a number of prestigious publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, Scientific American, Smithsonian, and he is also author of Time, Love, Memory, and His Brother's Keeper. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we're going to be flooded because this is just something that gets to all of us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to join us in the email version of the show, just go to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's my pleasure.
Oh, your book is fascinating, sir, isn't it? It is just so darned interesting.
I'm so glad you think so.
Yeah, it was really good. Well, we may as well start with this guy who is quite a character, and I think you describe him as such, Aubrey de Grey, and your many meetings with him and the story of Aubrey and his wife and his beard and what makes him think that this maintaining the body for 1,000 years is entirely possible.
Well, great. Yes, let's start with Aubrey. I'd been following this field for years. In fact, I'd been following it since the early 1980s when it was forlorn and a backwater. People barely knew what aging is back then. They had a lot of trouble marshaling funds to study aging in spite of the eternal interest of the subject. And then gradually, the field has heated up, and now the hottest speaker in the field is this man, Aubrey de Grey. He's British, from Cambridge, England. He was born in 63. He has a beard like a young Methuselah's down to his waist, brown beard. He's 6 feet tall, very thin, looks like a medieval saint, drinks beer from morning till night, says it suits his purposes to look unusual, and it suits his health to drink from morning till night. He eats almost nothing. And he is convinced that the way medicine is going now, we will, if we marshal the almost something on the scale of a Manhattan Project, we will see people living 1,000-year lifespans who are alive today.
Hmm.
So that's his argument. He was a computer scientist as a young man, and then he met and fell in love with an older woman, a biologist named Adelaide Carpenter, 20 years older than he.
Goodness.
And talking about biology over the breakfast table and the dinner table, he became fascinated by this problem of aging. He told me once that for some reason, his wife didn't like to talk about aging, but he himself was fascinated and became convinced that he could find a way to solve the problem.
And she still isn't fascinated. She's a character as well, a chain smoker who doesn't care about what he's doing, but they seem to love each other.
That's right. That's right. They're very close, but they don't see eye to eye about this mission to conquer aging.
Now, let's look at the history of this for a while, because you seem to be, and you, I think, have read this, and most people haven't, interested, and you have fascinating stories of what people have done to prolong human life for centuries. But you really reference quite frequently the history of life and death, Francis Bacon.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that an important work in this area?
Fascinating character, Sir Francis Bacon, you know, a contemporary of Shakespeare's. In fact, there are conspiracy theorists who like to argue that it was really Sir Francis who wrote Shakespeare's plays. He wrote beautifully himself. He was a tremendous prose stylist, best-selling essayist, in addition to a politician who rose very, very high and then had a horribly dramatic fall, almost at the gallows. And on the side, he more or less invented modern science. He was one of the great revolutionaries of what we now think of as modern science. And he thought the central project for modern science would be the cure of aging. And he wrote a book on the subject, as you say, The History of Life and Death. He wrote that toward the end of his own life, after he'd been kicked out of politics, kicked out of London, and he was in semi-retirement in an estate just outside the city. And the snow was falling, and he wasn't getting any younger, and he was pacing around in a mansion he couldn't afford to heat, writing, actually dictating to his doctor and secretary, this treatise about the central importance of this great goal of immortality. So it's a fascinating treatise. A lot of it is just sort of the potboiler health quackery of the day. We publish a lot of books like that, you know, even today, and probably the shelves will always be groaning with those books. So a lot of it is just grind up pearls and swallow them with your wine, pulverize gold and silver and swallow that with your wine. That'll help. But then he also argues that what he calls the higher physicians of the future should look at the cause underlying all disease. Why do we get sicker and frailer as we get older? Why does that have to happen? If only we could maintain our bodies, he says, as well as we did when we were 12 or 13 years old, we might live 1,000 years. Well, that's a really deep, it sounds simple, but it's a really deep point that people like Aubrey and other gerontologists make to this day. If we could do it then, why can't our bodies keep doing that? You know, we did it once. It's not as if it's impossible for human bodies to maintain themselves that well. And if we could, Bacon was right, if we could, then statistically speaking, you know, you look at the actuarial tables, life expectancy, your likelihood of dying of disease as a young boy or girl is very, very low, thank goodness. If only your likelihood of dying of disease could stay that low through your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and on, then statistically speaking, you'd be likely to live 1,000 years or more. And outliers might arrive at the golden age of 1,000,000 years.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, 1,000,000 years.
Yeah.
Is one of the central questions, why does the cell stop repairing itself? Is that what we need to figure out?
That's one of the key questions. You know, gerontologists, that's people who specialize in the study of aging, the science of aging, think they know why we evolved to be mortal. And that's a very interesting problem. We should talk about that.
Sure.
But they aren't sure yet where to look for the key damage that underlies aging. And that's an elaborate way of saying that they still don't really know what aging is, which is a strange situation for 21st century science to be in. I mean, in some ways, again, this is the core question for human mortals forever. It's been, why do I have to get old and die? And science really doesn't know what is happening in our bodies that makes us a little bit less sturdy year after year through most of our long adult lives. Why is that? Is it at the level of the cell? That's where a lot of people are looking now. And as you say, cells get less capable of sort of cleaning up after themselves mm-hmm. as they get older. You know, there are a lot of byproducts of metabolism in the cell. And so there are a lot of sweepers and garbage trucks and the vacuum cleaners, all kinds of maintenance equipment running all the time at the level of molecules, submicroscopic machinery that cleans up from the factories inside the cell, the mitochondria, which make our energy, for instance. There's a lot of crud. There's a lot of pollution, if you like, that is generated by our cellular factories. And we've got trillions of them in our bodies running all the time. So as our cells age, we are less efficient at sweeping up, cleaning up, vacuuming up inside the cell. And those are called housekeeping functions by biologists. For some reason, we get less efficient at housekeeping year by year as we get older. So one of the lines of research that's going on now in the science of aging is, how do you help speed the vacuum cleaner? You know, God speed the vacuum cleaner at the level of the cell. What can you do to keep our cells spick and span into our 80s, 90s, and even into the next century? And there's a lot of quack medicine.
Yes.
I was once watching TV and got caught up by an infomercial late at night for some mysterious potion that was a blend of 50 or 60 herbs, just the kind of herbs actually that Sir Francis Bacon was recommending back in the 1600s that were said to clean up our cells. That's the key, clean up our cells. So this kind of argument is not just in the labs, it's also out there in the wide and woolly West, sort of the whole murky zone outside traditional medicine, also talks about searching for ways to clean up the cells.
Yeah, why does Aubrey believe that this is the time for this? I mean, there's something. This is the moment we may see this, maybe not in our lifetime, in our grandchildren's lifetime, or we're going to add significant number of years, maybe even in our children's lifetime, somebody who's born in the year 2003. Why now?
Well, I think there are a few reasons why Aubrey and a few other people think that the time is right for a sort of war on aging. And one is just our track record of success. And if you look at the last 100 years, look at the 20th century. At the start of the 20th century, life expectancy in the United States, for instance, was only about 47 years. That is, a baby born in 1900 in the U.S. could expect, on average, less than 50 years. By the end of the 20th century, life expectancy in this country had reached almost 80. So that's a huge increase, and it's the first time in human history that life expectancy has been growing so quickly that we're aware of it in our own lifetimes. You know, you and I can hope that even though we know we're getting a day older today, our life expectancies are also increasing today because doctors and scientists are working away and gradually extending human lifespan even as we speak. So gerontologists estimate that every day we live, we get another 5 hours down the road.
Oh, I like that way of thinking about getting old.
That's almost a weekend for every week that's tacked on somewhere
right.
down the road. It's as if you're driving on a highway, and the road builders up ahead are extending that highway, not as fast as you're driving, but still fast enough to make a difference and lengthen your journey. And so what Aubrey argues is all we need to do is to start extending that highway a little bit faster and curing the diseases ahead faster and faster so that the road and we'll essentially have an infinite ride.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have many of them. A lot of people wanted to talk about this process of perhaps living a lot longer. Our guest is the author of Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. Jonathan Weiner is our guest. We have one line open if you'd like to take it, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, starting with Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to explain something. As you metabolize the Earth is not made out of the elements hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron like that. It's made out of things called isotopes. And these isotopes degrade and give off gamma and sometimes alpha and beta radiation, and your cells themselves, all parts of your body, are made of these things. As you're like a light bulb, and you're concentrating this stuff. As you eat, look at corn isolates an isotope oxygen, or carbon-13, and so we can tell how much of us is made out of carbon. Carbon-13, how much corn we eat. But you're concentrating this stuff. You're getting zapped inside your bodies. You can't live forever unless you could control your environment. If you made it out of only balanced isotopes, you sooner or later would become made out of balanced isotopes and you wouldn't glow like a light bulb and you wouldn't die.
Jonathan.
Well, there are a lot of sort of single cause explanations for aging out there, and radiation is one. Another that gets a lot of credence from scientists who study aging is mutations, and of course that's related to the problem of radiation in the environment or radiation in our own bodies, because radiation can damage the genes, damage the DNA, and mutations building up can lead to cancer, can also just gradually damage the works so that cells, again, become less efficient and we begin to decline. So some people think that that represents the ultimate limit, that we might push lifespan to, say, 120 years. We might have every chance of reaching 120, the way now, if we live right and we're lucky, we can hope to get somewhere into our 80s. But at that point, once you've reached the now extraordinary age of 120, you're going to have so many mutations accumulating in your cells that the works will more or less grind to a halt. So that's a plausible argument. It's not completely accepted. Almost everything in this science, I have to say, is controversial and much debated right now.
Yeah, that's what makes it interesting and fun too. That it's a lively discussion, isn't it?
It's really lively. It's fascinating. It's so highly charged. You know, I think that this is the one. Well, one of the areas of science that is not only hot right now, but also central for each of us. You know, this is one piece of intellectual ground that we all pace from very young. You know, from very young, each one of us has thought about this in one way or another, mortality. And why does it have to be? And in one way or another, it strikes us all the time. All through our lives, we're sorting out these questions for ourselves. And that's part of the reason I find it so interesting to hang around with these scientists who are trying one way or another to understand it at this fundamental level. And I have to say, it's not, you know, there are really two questions here that we all worry about. There's the can we questions, if I really live right, if I floss my teeth, if I, you know, if I walk instead of driving and get a lot of exercise, is there a way that I can stay healthy to 100? You know, that's the can we, and then the scientists extend that. Can we extend it another right. decade or two beyond what anybody's getting now?
Yeah.
That's on the one side. And then the other questions, besides the can we, are should we questions. Mm-hmm. Do I really want that? Would I want to live to 120, much less Aubrey de Grey's 1,000 years or even a million years? Would it be good for me? Would it be good for my family? Would it be good for society, for the planet? Those are enormous questions. And really, I think if you put them in the balance, the can we questions and the should we questions, they're both incredibly difficult. They're both tough. And I think we're going to be debating both of them, following both of them for the rest of our lives, because you asked before, Kathleen, why now? Why are people talking about this now? Part of the reason, of course, is that so many people on the planet are aging, including here in the United States, where we're seeing the aging of the baby boom. And it's weird for those of us, including me, who are part of the baby boom. You know, our generation is defined by the very name, by youth. But now we're graying like every generation before us. And that's going, in itself, that's going to drive a tremendous interest in the phenomenon of aging, the social impact of aging, the politics of aging,
yes.
All of that we're starting to see now, and it's only going to increase over the next decade or two.
Greg, thanks for the call. Bill in Madison is next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. First of all, I'm just going to make a comment and take my reaction off the air, but I'm a baby boomer, so I'm pushing up on the bottom side of 60. And I personally think it's a terrible idea, the idea of human beings living any longer than they do now, simply because, you know, we are an apex predator. For the first time in Earth history, there's an apex predator of there's 7 billion of us. We're stacked with consuming, eating, defecating, urinating, stinking human flesh.
Don't hold that.
Piled like tarred cordwood. And we're already reproducing faster than the replacement value. So the idea that nobody dies, I mean, where are we going to, on a philosophical level, I think that there should be a limit to how much one generation can screw things up.
Jonathan.
Well, Bill, well put. I think that's probably the biggest argument against this enterprise that Aubrey de Grey and others are promoting. As I was saying, there's the can we question and the should we question. And when you look at should we, that's the first thing you have to ask. Since we're already sort of an inverted pyramid resting on the planet, this very unstable situation, as you say, of apex predators, human carnivores, having taken over almost all of the planet's resources, controlling so much, it's an unstable situation. And you look at the pollution that our generation is causing and the problems we're bequeathing to the next generation. How can you ask for more time on the planet when you've done, when you look at what we've done with it, with the time we've had so far? I think those are very valid questions. And I'm not sold on Aubrey's own answer to that question. In fact, this is where Aubrey alienates probably most of the people in his audiences when he speaks to a general crowd. He says, look, in the developed world, as life expectancy has increased, people have tended to have fewer children. In agrarian societies, you tend to see large families, you know, 7 kids, 8 kids, 12 kids. And now in developed countries like the United States, much of Europe, you see the opposite. You see families with one child or no children, or people waiting until they're significantly older before starting families. So what he argues is, if we had a life expectancy of 200, 500 years, people would hold off having kids maybe indefinitely. And so he says very cheerfully that very soon, once there's a cure for aging, there'll be almost nobody around under the age of 50. And Aubrey thinks that would be an improvement. Aubrey isn't too fond of children, and he thinks that would be a one of the delightful side effects of a cure of aging is we'd all be grown-ups. He says, why shouldn't we be our own next generation?
There also is a point. Another thing I love about the book is that you are very widely read, and there's a lot of literature and Shakespeare and Yeats. And there are a lot of people in this book, but this is a wonderful quote from Truman Capote in his self-portrait. After all, there is such a thing as life saturation, the point where everything is pure effort and total repetition. He's got a point, doesn't he?
That's right. That's right. And there's a great philosopher, 20th century philosopher, who argued that if you could live for centuries, you'd end up feeling like an opera singer who is singing the same aria, the same opera, stuck in the same show over and over, day and night. Maybe it would be like that. It's very hard to know.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, the only immortal cells we've got on us is cancer and sex cells. Those are the only ones that are immortal. And in 1962, Leonard Hayflick took cell out of human body, put in a petri dish, fed it with all the proper nutrients, perfect environment, and found out that it will divide only 55 times. That comes to, translated in human terms, it comes to about 120 years. If you take a Galapagos turtle, its cells will divide 125 times, which means that it lives to be 170, 180, maybe 190, something like that, and so on. So what's limiting life is not some fancy philosophy or a lot of hot air. What is limiting life is that the cells will only reproduce themselves a certain amount of time, and inside the cell there's a thing called chromosomes, which is in the nucleus of the cell, and every time your cell divides, you lose a little piece of that. And so the reason is because when it replicates, it doesn't replicate the whole thing. And those are called telomeres. And telomeres shorten as you get older, and pretty soon your cells can no longer divide. They stick together, and you wind up sitting in a nursing home in a wheelchair taking Tylenol.
Well, Mike, that is another one of the reigning hypotheses about the cause of aging. But if you subscribe to that one and call all the others hot air, I think you're missing some of the fun of this field, because part of the interest now is that there are many theories getting kicked around. The telomeres seem to be important, but it's not as neat, quite as neat as you're saying. I mean, there are other animals that have long telomeres but don't have long lifespans, short telomeres that do have long lifespans relative to sibling species. So that's not... it's not cut and dried. It's not cut and dried. The whole field is still blundering around, really, trying to figure out, is there a single simple explanation like that for what cuts our lives short, what cuts our lives long. You know, what causes this phenomenon we call mortality? I suppose if you want to call it hot air, we've been blowing hot air forever. You know, we've been arguing about this since the days of the Greek myth. Mm. Telomeres haven't really answered the question, although they've added an important detail. And these arguments about the buildup of metabolic byproducts in the cell, those are also compelling. The arguments about mutations building up in the cells, those are compelling. And there may still be something else out there that people haven't figured out yet that turns out to be extremely important in the process of aging.
You ask us in the book, and I must say that never in my pretty long life so far have I considered the hydra. And you ask us to do that because it is the one animal that may be practically immortal. Tell me about the people who are studying the hydra and why we should consider it.
That's a really interesting point, the hydra. The hydra is this tiny freshwater organism. You can see it very easily with a microscope. Some of them you can see with the naked eye if you've got very good naked eyes. They live in ponds and puddles. They look a little bit like squid, like a medusa. They are made up of maybe 20 different kinds of cells, and they have stem cells in their stalks and then tentacles waving around. And the stem cells are able to regenerate all of their working parts, the tentacles, even the stalk, so that they are essentially immortal. They will live and thrive, according to present thinking, as long as their puddle doesn't dry up.
Oh.
So they're not literally immortal. They're still susceptible to all the slings and arrows of nature, but they don't seem to age. And there are other animals out there also that seem to live extraordinarily long lives or even age free lives. Negligible aging has been found in certain mollusks, for instance, in certain species of clams, in sponges. Why is that exactly? It may be that because those are organisms that have very, very simple nervous systems, they're able to let go of the nerve cells as they get older and replace them with new ones without a great deal of loss. But you and I, really, we're our memories. Our identities are made up so much of our rich histories, which we carry with us. And we can't afford, as complicated organisms with central nervous systems, with big brains, we can't afford, perhaps, goes one argument, to replace all of that all the time with stem cells in order to stay young forever. Mm. So maybe the gift of memory is part of the reason that we're mortal.
Oh, that's interesting. Because how in the world could you remember if you were 500?
Right.
You just have a really hard time, wouldn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, it would be a long, long time ago, kindergarten.
It sure would. We got to get to some of these really interesting little tidbits that you include in here. I had no idea. Who knew in the late 19th century, grafting monkey testicles onto an old man, people believe that you would be immortal or you would just live longer?
You'd rejuvenate your interest in the opposite sex,
huh.
And you would have the powers and potency that you had when you were a young stud in college. That was the idea. And a lot of old men went for that.
Oh,
a lot
my
of wealthy
gosh.
Old men went in for that. It wasn't grafting monkey testicles. There was another operation that was supposed to rejuvenate the bedroom powers of elderly men, and that was vasectomies. For a while, a guy, I think his name was Voronov, became a celebrity surgeon in Europe performing vasectomies with the idea that those would have these wonderful rejuvenating powers. And one of the people who went in for that was Sigmund Freud.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And William Butler Yeats.
That's right. And Yeats was convinced that it worked for him, and he wrote all this glorious love poetry and had wild, tumultuous affairs in his old age, caused all kinds of scandals in Dublin. In fact, they used to call him the gland old man.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Let's go to Dave in West Salem. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Well, hence the term monkey love, I guess. But a couple of things. One, in the last century, AMA talks about public health, impact of public health on society and how, it's impacted our life expectancy. And there were debates during the century whether public health was a good thing because it took away from this natural life cycle or people dying. But I have a different view of this, I think, thinking about life. And I have two adopted daughters, and I adore them, and they've made my life so complete. And yet, on occasion, I catch myself thinking about, since life emerged, there's a continuum, and I'm part of that continuum. And that with me, that continuum ends, and it makes me a little sad. And I think that's part of our, part of this kind of psychological wanting to live forever, passing on our genetic makeup. I'm wondering what you think of or learned about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do feel so much, we feel that need, especially as we get older, that need to feel that we're passing something on to the next generation, that part of us will live on. And that, too, is a kind of immortality or a strategy for immortality. And it matters to almost everybody that we should leave something good of ourselves when we go. And different people, I think, put their eggs in different baskets. And if you're raising two children and giving them the best that you can as a father, then I think you can feel really wonderful about what you're leaving the world, what you're giving to the future.
Yeah.
But we all think about those questions, and this gets far beyond the science, the can we, but it gets into the should we questions. It's interesting, isn't it, that the science really follows this yearning in us. It's driven by this yearning to contribute to the next generation and contribute to the future and be here in some way far into the future. So someone like Aubrey de Grey is pushing literally the dream of being here far into the future. And most of us are thinking about some less tangible presence, gift and presence in the future. But the yearning, I think we all have in common.
I wouldn't mind just dropping in every year for about a week. That would be my ideal, to see what's going on. I want to see what's happening.
Yeah.
That'd
yeah,
be all right.
I know. As journalists, that would be that would be heaven.
That's it. That's what it is. It's a journalist. We also need to speak about, because this other guy who you write about, Martin Raff, is much more comfortable with growing older and retired early to make way for people to move up in the profession, and looks at it fully enjoying each one of the life cycles that he's in. And there's something reassuring and comfortable about that.
Yes, he is a cell biologist at University College London, so not too far from my main character, so to speak, Aubrey. And I spent time in England talking with both of them, and I was fascinated by Martin's level of comfort with mortality. I mean, Martin is someone who studies not only the life of the cell, but also the cell's intuition, you might say, when it's time to go, cells do self-destruct. There's a kind of cell suicide called apoptosis. And cells are highly tuned to that ability to sense when they're no longer needed and when they should go. And Martin is acutely aware of being a mortal human being and was very willing to step down and retire from an illustrious career as a scientist when he reached 65. And he's also made peace, he says, with getting older and dying. He has children, he has grandchildren, and he says he would... The worst thing you could say to him would be that you'd found a way to give him another 5 years. He just wants what's coming, and that's it.
Yeah. More phone calls momentarily. I keep thinking in the back of my mind is stem cell research, too, and I need to ask Jonathan about that, and we'll take more of your phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. Jonathan is the author of Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. He is a Pulitzer, sorry, I've mispronounced that for years, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Beak of the Finch. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public. Peg in Rice Lake is our next caller. Hey, Peg.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wonder if anyone has done any research on the possibility that aging might be due to the years-long attacks by bacteria, viruses, what is it, prions, things like that. I'm suffering from late-stage Lyme disease, and that's something that conventional doctors don't even believe in because they can't find it in the body. Also, post-polio syndrome, they don't find that virus remaining in the body. But these people are suffering from something. And then there's shingles. That's another one, the chickenpox virus. Has anyone worked on that?
Well, that's an interesting question, Peg. We get more susceptible to infections from viruses and bacteria as we get older. And gerontologists work on that quite a bit. What is it that makes us less able to fend off these bugs as we get older? I haven't heard anybody argue that it's the infections themselves, the bugs themselves that are bringing us down. But I have heard some people argue that the inflammation that results from infections is a kind of nasty damage that can be important in aging, maybe is even central in aging. There's a school of thought that chronic inflammation is the key to the problem. Hmm. So there's a link.
Yeah. Can we talk for just a moment about stem cell research? How does that fit into all of this?
Well, that's really important. In some ways, that's central because stem cells are able to create all the other cells in the body. They're able to rebuild and rebuild us. And so in any future for what's known as regenerative medicine, you have to have an ability to guide and coax stem cells to do their work even better than they do it now. That's why that work is so important in hopes for life extension, dramatic life extension. And it's also vital for conventional medicine, for the conquest of all sorts of horrible diseases that are troubling us now. So this country needs much, much better management of stem cell research. We need to be fostering it rather than holding it back.
Thanks, Peg, for the call. Boots is next from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Speaking of faith, had a beautiful thing on stem cell research a little while ago.
Huh.
But I have a recommendation and just a playful observation. There was a 10-hour play that I saw by Bernard Shaw in Milwaukee maybe 5 years ago called Back to Methuselah. And in this play, it was this idea that humans evolved to the point where they can think themselves healthier. And they were living into 100, 200, 1,000 years, and the humans that were really old thought it was better for them to separate themselves from the younger 100-year-old humans. A fascinating play, though. But the playful observation was in looking at the research at the Large Hadron Collider and how they're looking at atomic particles and subatomic particles. And it just seems to me that right now we live our lives, our society, our human societies are living lives in a way based on how we understand physical structure at a molecular level. And I'm just wondering if as we learn what physical structure is at a subatomic level, if we start to understand what understanding is, so we understand what serotonin and dopamine and oxytocin, what actually at the subatomic level those thoughts are, what consciousness is, if we will maybe be able to think ourselves healthier.
Jonathan.
Wow. Well, I think you're pointing out how little we know, and I think it's always worth pointing that out, how little we really know. I mean, the physicists think now that all the matter that we know of in the universe is only a tiny fraction of the matter that exists. They talk about dark matter. Well, if there's that much more to find out, then who knows how those discoveries will change the way we think about the way molecules work, for instance. So I think that's a valid point. It may be, though, that those discoveries at the subatomic or sub-sub-subatomic level, you know, down to these superstrings that the cosmologists like to talk about now, some of them, it may be that that's a whole level down or 12 levels down from the mechanics of what makes serotonin hook up with serotonin receptors. And so it won't change things that much in terms of the engineering of healthy bodies and sound minds. It may be that that will be where a revolution comes. It may be that it will be a revolution unto itself and won't change too much what happens at the everyday level of human experience.
Hmm. And here's an email from Karen in Milwaukee. If you analyze lifespan at the beginning of the 20th century by cause of death, what was the lifespan for an adult, say, 21 years old, who lives without needing antibiotics and who doesn't get one of the diseases we now vaccinate against? The analysis of mummies is showing that they did not get cancer. Are we really living healthier lives, or is our medicine simply prolonging the lives of unhealthy adults?
No, we really are living healthier, longer lives. There's no question. And in fact, cancer existed back in the days of the Egyptians. The very first description of cancer is found in hieroglyphics in the world's oldest surviving medical text. And it's a clear description of breast cancer, and it ends with the doctor and scribe writing in hieroglyphics, "No known cure." So we're doing better with all of these diseases, including cancer. And a parting thought, the thought that I carry around with me having spent these years working on this book, is how different is it really to be working on all these diseases like cancer individually, and we all hope that we will find cures for these diseases, and working on aging, which predisposes us to all of these diseases. Is there really such a strong gap between the hope of conquering cancer, let's say, and the hope of conquering aging?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a deep question, I think. You can argue it and you can argue it, but I think we're going to be thinking about that question more and more, because if you could slow aging, then wouldn't you be striking a blow all at once against all the late onset diseases?
Right. Oh, Jonathan, what a fascinating hour and book, too. Thank you so much for being with us.
It really was a pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Jonathan Weiner, you spell his last name Weiner. The book is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Beak of the Finch and is considered one of the most distinguished popular science writers in this country. Tomorrow we broadcast from the Milwaukee Art Museum. We're going to have a wonderful time. There's still time for you to call and say you're going to join us there. So do that, or say you will on our Facebook. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this show.